Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turteltaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from Philadelphia is Seth Whitelaw. Seth is President and CEO of Whitelaw Compliance Group. He's also the author of the chapter Healthcare Compliance Programs from Murky Beginnings to Establish Expectations in the new Complete Healthcare Compliance Manual. Seth, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, our pleasure too. So now, while many people think of compliance programs beginning with U.S. federal sentencing guidelines, I think it's important to note that the roots go back much further. What would you say was the genesis of compliance programs?
I would say that the genesis probably started around with the Defense Initiative. And this goes back, probably into the late 70s, early 80s, and involved the $3,000 hammer, the very expensive toilet seats that we all heard about that were in the press. And the government was trying to root out corruption and overbilling from defense contractors.
Well, I'm old enough to remember that era, so it was quite the shocking news. Now, the importance, though, of the federal sentencing guidelines, I don't think really can be understated. I think for two reasons. First, they apply to every industry and every type of organization. And in addition, because the elements were so hard to argue against, they made compliance programs seem so logical to implement, but yet some continue to resist. Why do you think there remains these people who say, no, we don't need this?
I think there are a couple of reasons for that. First, remember, compliance is an expense, no matter how you want to look at it. It is not a cheap undertaking to do it well. And therefore, when you have scarce resources, especially with smaller companies that are focusing on getting, say, their initial product onto market, they don't necessarily have any extra cash, and they certainly don't want to put any extra resources into the compliance bucket. But I also think there are another group of folks who I think go, well, you know, we are compliant, we are ethical, we do have integrity, we don't need somebody telling us how to behave or what to do from that perspective, and we're not going to be like the other unfortunate enforcement actions in our industry, so we're somehow different than that. So I think there is in some cases, a bit of self-delusion that goes on of saying we're somehow different from others.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to make, because I it's hard for people to admit often that, you know, the people that they've invested their trust in may not be worthy of it, or just may be human and slip up, and inevitably things are going to go awry. Now, the guidelines is important.
Well, go ahead. But Adam, I would add one other thing that came to mind would be the fact that showing the advantages of compliance is very difficult to do. Finding measurable statistics, so, you know, the infamous return on investment, it's very hard to quantify that for a CEO who's asking, well, if I spend this amount of money, what do I get back for it? There's no quantifiable way to do that. You can show him all the fines and penalties and settlements that you would like, but the government has routinely told us that it is a benefit to have the compliance program, and that if you get into an enforcement action, it will in fact give you a benefit. But when asked for statistics, they go, well, we can't provide those statistics, even anonymized data. So we have no data to work from. So it's very hard to sell to a cost-conscious CEO the fact that compliance is actually going to be a benefit in the long run for his company, and that he can has some measurable statistics to be able to take back to his board, for example.
Yeah, unfortunately, that thinking does tend to pop up more often than it should, you know, and part of it has to do with the fact that, look, when it comes to compliance, it's often hard to document what it saved you necessarily in pains and penalties. And, you know, when it comes to tracking incidents, one of the issues is people don't come forward and say, hey, I almost committed a felony yesterday, but then I remembered the training. It just unfortunately doesn't happen. Let's go back to the guidelines. As important as they aren't the only authority out there. The OIG at HHS has had enormous impact, especially in healthcare. What do you see as some of the most important contributions that HHS has made?
I think perhaps the biggest contribution that the OIG's made is they issued for, not for every industry, but you can certainly glean the general gist from reading all of the compliance program guidance that they have put out, where they have attempted to take the bare bones of the eight elements and say, well, okay, this is how it could look or might look or should look. And so they put more meat on those bones for those of us in compliance to try to figure out how this should work. So, you know, when we talk about who is a high level official within the organization, the OIG tries to give you some guidance as to what does that look like. When you're talking about risk assessment, they try to give you some guidance about what does a good risk assessment look like. So from that perspective, they have essentially put flesh on the bones that the federal sentencing guidelines gave us. And in particular, that's important because, as you noted at the outset, the guidelines apply to all industries. And so there's really no way for them to get that kind of specificity because each industry is different. Each organization is different within the industries. And so I think the OIG has done a good job from a healthcare perspective of giving us something to work from. So for example, even in the pharmaceutical world, even though the guidance dates back to 2003, it's still useful guidance, and I even refer to it today. So it's helpful.
Yeah, and what's been nice too is they've been very upfront about continuing to provide guidance in a very constructive manner. Now, we're seeing updated guidance coming out of the Department of Justice. How do you think that will affect the evolution of compliance programs?
Well, I think in the short answer is for the better. I think the long answer to that question is it's pushing compliance officers to ask the fundamental question of, we can say we have all of the boxes in place, but does it really work? Is it really changing behavior? Is it really deterring people from behaving badly? Are we getting the right results out of the program that we were hoping to get? I think it's also a good reminder, especially in this most recent update that they've done, about saying, you know, companies gather lots and lots of data. Some of it they use, a lot of it sits on the shelf sometimes. They have made a lot of emphasis around, you should be looking at your data and doing trending and analysis to see what signals it's telling you so that you can adjust your program accordingly. And I think that's an excellent reminder for all of us out there that there's probably resources we don't know that we have, and we're not necessarily using all of our resources to the fullest potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely pushes to sort of level up. And certainly when it comes to the area of data, they've been very adamant about the importance of having, well, not just having it, but having it in a central place where you can actually read real information from it. Finally, I want to leverage all the history that you have with compliance programs. What do you see coming next for compliance?
I think, for me, in the roles that I'm playing, I think you're going to see a very marked shift, maybe not this year, maybe not next year, maybe in a couple of years. I think the question of independence is going to become a very big issue. And by that, I mean, compliance is probably the toughest job within the company. You're not usually the most senior person in the room when you're having conversations with senior leaders. You're expected to convince them on the appropriateness or inappropriateness of certain courses of action. You're looked to as a front line of defense. And then the government in recent cases has been saying, but if you don't do enough, you yourself as a compliance officer can be liable. And I think there's going to come a time when compliance officers are going to want, A, the protection of being independent, but also the freedom that comes with being independent, totally independent from the company. In other words, you are a consultant as opposed to being an employee, to be able to push the message that you need to deliver and have it heard by the recipients on the other end from that perspective. So I see that as a trend that's coming. The other big trend that I see is coming is at some point we're going to figure out how to use all of this data we're gathering, couple it with artificial intelligence, and have it help us do some of the work that we now have to do through just, you know, putting our eyes on the data ourselves and using our experience to say, oh, this outlier or that outlier is important or not important, or we need to worry about this or we don't need to worry about that. We haven't yet figured out how to get the machines to help us do that, but I think that's coming.
Well, both of those would be revolutionary steps, and certainly the idea of moving compliance sort of out of the organization would definitely be quite the revolution. Well, Seth, thank you for sharing these insights with us here and also for contributing your chapter, Healthcare Compliance Programs, From Murky Beginnings to Establish Expectations, for the complete Healthcare Compliance Manual. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA. I hope we're able to expand your compliance perspective.